Word of mouth.
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 This may date me a little bit, but I speak the truth. I'm not going to lie to you people. I'm amazed by the things that I see around me every day in this world. I'm amazed.
I'm Brady Carlson, and this is a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Today we're listening to Ira Flatto, host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday. He spoke to a sold-out audience at the University of New Hampshire about his long career as a science journalist and about how science and journalism have evolved along the way. As I joined Flatto on stage, I grabbed my trusty Android tablet, and I savored the moment social media style.
Well, thank you all for coming. I just have to send a tweet here. At UNH with Ira Flatto of Sci-Fry, this is awesome. Send. Thanks for indulging me. And thank you for coming to New Hampshire.
I love to. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I wanted to talk about Twitter since you mentioned it just a moment ago, and because that's something that I love and cherish. You guys were streaming online before most of us knew what online was all about. And you've been kind of the early adopters in our business different technologies.
We believe that as a science and technology show, we should be on the cutting edge. And in fact, we had we were on the air streamed live in 1993. And the name of the show was What is the Internet? People hadn't heard about it. And we introduced some new wild concept called the World Wide Web. And it was hard to describe it in those days if you hadn't seen it. So the show went out to California, got digitized at Park, and came back, and both people who could listen to it did.
I was going to say, was it difficult to do a show about what is the Internet for people who may or may not already know what the Internet is?
It was. We had people who were inventing the World Wide Web, and they were trying to describe what this text and the language and whatever was, and if you don't actually look at point-and-click stuff. We never did those things in that day. It was, you know, a terminal, and you typed stuff and things, and it was hard to picture what would happen. But we've actually re-released it lately, and people have just glommed onto it, listening back to ancient history, you know, 1993.
As an early adopter, you test out some things that maybe don't make it to the rest of us, and you were one of the early adopters of the virtual world called Second Life.
Yes.
Now, for those who remember Second Life, it was sort of this parallel universe where you had a little person. My person, I think, is still flying around the Second Life
universe.
It
still exists.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah. So what was it like to have a virtual Ira Flatto hosting Science Friday in Second Life?
It was actually, if you can think of a cartoon of a Science Friday, that's what it looked like in Second Life. And we had to buy real estate. They had actually purchased the real estate and put it in a good location. Second Life could only host about 300 people at a time at one spot. Now, we have an audience of 1.25 million live listeners on Science Friday. 300 is not a lot of people. But the University of Denver bought some adjoining real estate on a property line so we could actually put our chairs, which they were, it's a little amphitheater we created, over the property line and double our size to almost 800 people, you know. But it was not cheap to do. It took time to do it. And after a while, we figured we're not getting, you know, it's a cool experiment, but we have to put the same resources into 800 people as we do to 1.5 million and then 200,000 Twitter members. So it wasn't really worth it for us.
It was fun while it lasted.
It was fun. We are looking for that, you know, edge right there.
Well, I read a criticism recently about the web and its influence on politics. And the criticism went sort of like this. He said, because the web is so immediate, because it deals in these bite-sized pieces of information that we react to instantly, that it's turning campaigns into sort of an endless litany of people getting disgusted with each other and sharing their disgust about a particular news event, about a particular gaffe, about a particular story. Do you have any concern in scientific circles that because of the nature of the web, because of that immediacy, because of that digestible size component, that it's changing our popular perception of science, it's changing the kind of science that gets featured on the news?
Well, I think it's good on the one hand to have people engaged in talking about science. And there's just so many things you can say in 140 characters, you know. which means you really can't say very much. But science takes thought. It takes a while to digest things and think about them. Albert Einstein had a very famous little phrase when someone asked him a question and he didn't know the answer. He used to say, "I give a little tink." You know, so he would actually go away and walk around for, you know, he would take a walk every day and think of big thoughts about how to answer some of these questions. We all know the tyranny of the enter button, right? How many times we're upset that we pressed that enter button when we thought, gee, maybe I should not have sent that email or that Twitter because I didn't really mean to be that harsh or to make instant judgments. For us, it's meant that we have to grow another layer of skin because we'll get instant reactions, not only from the Twitter members, but from people who call in. And sometimes they interact. We had Alan Alda on. I don't know if you heard the Alan Alda show a few weeks ago. And the next guest, I said goodbye to Alan. He talked about his life in science and science popularizing. The next caller came on and just trashed Alan Alda, you know, totally trashed him, said that why are we putting such fluff on the air? And I, you know, trying to be objective and not to be critical, I mean, I answered it back in my own way, in a different way. But the Twitter community came alive. It was amazing. It was lit up in his defense. So there was one interesting reaction immediately from, you know, Vox Populi about what they thought about the interview.
It almost seems like there's a perception that there's a zero-sum game. You either have to have an Alan Alda or you have to have the purest researcher in the history of science, and it's not necessarily the case.
No,
you know, there's room
yes.
for the cure for cancer, and there's room for the guy trying to recreate the Star Trek phaser.
Well, there's a. I hope you're all set on stun there. My dilithium crystals are running out. I do believe that we need to bring thinkers on who think outside the box. We're going to do a show this Friday on thorium as a fuel for nuclear reactors. I've been getting a lot of people saying, "Why don't you look into thorium? It could be the answer." Blah blah blah. You get it from all sides. Well, at least expose the public to some ideas that they've never heard before. We may not, you know, give an absolute balanced account at that moment, but if you listen to the show long enough and hard enough, you will eventually hear all sides of the issue. One of the biggest challenges we face is if you have a subject with very, you know, few supporters on one end and a lot of supporters on the other end, if you bring... Let's take global warming. If you bring on a global warming denier, and that represents 5% of the population, with a global warming expert, that represents 95% of the population. If I do one-on-one, it looks like it's a 50-50 split. And that's just a phony way to look at it.
This week in New Hampshire, there's the 2012 Formula Hybrid Competition going on at New Hampshire International Speedway in Loudoun. There are teams from 39 colleges that are building these single-seat little hybrid or electric
yeah.
cars and racing them around the track, which just sounds so fun.
Not into the wind tunnel, I hope.
For their sake.
I like that.
I mean, it seems like there's a realization that the tinkerer in the garage and the engineer or the scientist in the lab may actually be the same person. And bringing them together in settings
yes.
like this, you know, we have
yes.
FIRST Robotics as another example
right.
of that. Bringing them together is a way to not just promote science, but to also come up with those out-of-the-box ideas.
There's a huge amount of creativity out there. And in our young people and our youth, our teenagers, there are these events like that you're talking about, and even on the larger scale called Maker Fairs, where tens of thousands of people come out on a weekend to watch projects in booths, thousands of booths around a fairgrounds, where kids, and I mean anybody under 30, have put together these incredible contraptions, devices, 3D printers, helicopters, all kinds of stuff on their own, in their own garages, and are looking, you know, to be entrepreneurs, looking for help, looking to just exchange ideas with one another. And if you just have any doubt that there is a loss of Yankee ingenuity out there, you just have to go to one of these fairs and you will see an incredible amount of it. And we try as much as we can to give some sunshine to that. You know, we bring on kids and kid inventors. We try to show this creativity out there. We actually go to the fair. There's going to be one in Boise this year. We're going to go out to Boise and bring Science Friday and talk about a big fair in Boise.
With that idea that, you know, the maker fairs are where the sort of the youthful creativity is, does that then suggest that in formal educational settings that there is not the youthful creativity? And if so, how do you bring that back?
It's interesting that there are a couple of interesting studies just out in the last couple of years that show that people learn most of their science outside of school, in informal science education places, outside of the classroom, in science museums, listening on the radio, watching TV, going to maker fairs. This is where they are learning their real science. And it's quite startling, but the data is very good on this, that people are learning these things on their own, seeking it out. It's not surprising to me, as I said before, every time we go to a place and talk about science and look at the room around us, it gets filled up with people who want to talk about science. Science is fascinating. It answers the two big questions that theologians and philosophers have been asking the same way forever. Where did we come from and where are we going? Everybody wants to know the answer to those questions.
I wanted to ask about something that you've been talking about a lot on Science Friday, and that is the end of the space shuttle program. And I know that you got to see one of the shuttles as it was coming into New York on its way to its final destination. But Neil deGrasse Tyson has been speaking out a lot as the shuttle program has come to an end. And he said essentially what this means is we've stopped dreaming about the future, that if we're not using the space program to look forward and start thinking about the world that we want to envision in 30, 40, 50 years, that's going to be a real big problem for the generations coming down the pike. What do you make of the end of the space program?
Well, I think it's symptomatic of a lot of things, and one of those problems is that the inability for us to tackle big issues, tackle big questions, solve problems that may take a decade or more. One of the interesting aspects of the success of the space program is that it spanned 1, 2, 3 presidencies or more, and people did not cancel it while it was happening. They allowed it to go through. We need to be able to think big ideas and then make sure we're all on the same page of carrying them through so that the next president, the next Congress, whatever, doesn't cancel what the last person did. And other countries realize this, and they are able to do it. I think our polarization of our political system is showing up in science and technology that way, that is allowing other, you know, China, India, they've all said they're going to the moon. They've almost put dates on them. I actually got the head of the science division of NASA last week to actually put a date on when he wanted to go to the moon. I think it was 2033. I can't remember the exact date. But he was at least thinking about it and thought he had to mention a date when I pressed him on it. But not just space. It's energy. It's technology. It's all kinds of stuff. You know, we have solar panels now so cheaply made, and they're not our solar panels. Why are we not putting them everywhere? They cost next to nothing, you know, relatively speaking. Why aren't we thinking outside of the box and getting these things that are very, very cheap into greater usage? So,
do you see the opportunities that are coming up then in the non-public world? So if NASA is slowing down on some of these developments that you're seeing, you are seeing some private, yes, initiatives. You're seeing, you know, there was the story about the asteroid mining team that they wanted to go out into space. And there is a contest going on where a private citizen is going to be in one of these suborbital flights. Right. And actually a UNH graduate, John Herman, is one of the finalists in that, if anybody here knows him. Is that going to be comparable? The next step?
Oh, yeah. I think there's going to be space tourism already, where people will get rocket ships are being made to take people into suborbital space. The space program, I mean, in its raw sense, created a lot of jobs. You know, it created a lot of jobs in a lot of states, and politicians realize this. The reason why the Johnson Space Center is in Houston is because Lyndon Johnson was president. You know, as soon as those rockets leave the launch pad, control goes over to Houston. Why? You know, it's because that's where the money went, you know. I think it was always shown that the space industry creates jobs, and I don't understand why, you know, we can't use exploration and job creating at the same time. It seems like a no-brainer.
You mentioned before about popular culture embracing science as a Big Bang Theory, and I mean, I think of the shows that I grew up watching, and the best science that we had was the robot talking car on Knight Rider. Everything else was just action. It was not comparable to now.
That's coming back.
Yeah, it is. You have all the CSI shows, for example, which may or may not always be scientifically accurate, but there is that.
Well, that's an interesting point. The CSI show, Leon Lederman, who was a physicist, won a Nobel Prize in physics, trying to convince Hollywood producers that they should make a sitcom or something in a laboratory just to show how scientists, you know, work and that they're real people. And suddenly the industry itself now, the reason why the Big Bang Theory is popular and it actually exists is because there are private people who work in the industry who see that people really like science. And we're going to create it if, you know, ourselves. We don't need a scientist telling us to do it. We realize it The demand is there itself. We'll create a sitcom about it. We'll create Mythbusters. We'll create other shows that have some sort of science theme to them. Even though you may not like the nerdy idea behind them, it still gets people to think about science, and the science in those programs are real. That section I was showing is about magnetic monopoles, which is a real interesting idea. But it's now sort of springing up from the ground roots. When popular culture and theater, a lot of movies coming out, there have been plays on, in Broadway. There are personalities that we're going to be seeing, science personalities who we're going to be seeing movies come out about them. Finally, the industry, the entertainment industry, I think is realizing that there is this great interest.
And in a way now, they can talk about science, but they can even participate. I mean, we see so many more now, the citizen science projects where people can go out and take a reading and bring it back to, the lead researcher that's crowdsourcing, everybody tell us when you first felt the earthquake kind of moments. And there's a parallel to journalism in a way. Everybody can participate in the development of journalism, even if they're not necessarily a journalist, just as people can participate in science, even if they're not necessarily working in a lab or teaching at a university. So is that where science is going now? It's a practice that some people do all the time and most people do occasionally or some of the time?
I think we'll always have scientists, but I think what we're seeing now because of the social communities is the ability to expand what amateur scientists have been doing all the time. Our country was founded by amateur scientists. Benjamin Franklin, who some people consider the best scientist America ever, still to this day, ever produced, was an amateur scientist. He was a very serious scientist. There were natural scientists. We used to say science used to be called natural philosophy in the old days. People went around and looked at plants and animals and studied them. The museums are full of them now. And we even had private companies that were funding, science or funding expeditions. Today we see James Cameron going down, right? Goes down to the deepest part of the ocean. He's doing that by himself. We don't even have a diving vessel. And there is no government diving vessel that could do that. He had to do that himself. Other countries are funding these sorts of things. So we are depending more and more on amateurs to do the things, if he hears me call him an amateur, he's going to get very upset. But he's not a professional scientist. But like you say, you don't have to do all of those things, X, Y, and Z, to become an amateur scientist and make a contribution. And speaking of, you mentioned something that was very interesting that we helped move along. There was a crowdsourcing of what's called a protein folding problem. And there were problems in figuring out the best way to fold up a protein. And so they put this site on the web for people to actually try it out themselves. And what they discovered and what computer scientists know is that despite how smart the biggest computers in the world are, people are still the best at pattern recognition.
Because the computer will still try and do the same
our brains
technique
still
over and over.
Have been recognizing patterns for 2 million years, And so the people were better at, it's like a Rubik's Cube. I can see how that folds and how it should fold. And the people solved the problem that the computers could not solve.
I've got one last question before we start taking questions from our audience here at the University of New Hampshire. According to the groundbreaking research done a few years back by the Back to the Future movie series, it's 2012. We are just three years away from jetpacks.
Ah, yes, jetpacks.
First, are you excited about that? And second, is there a gadget or a device that maybe doesn't exist yet, but you'd just like to see it invented, not because it would be a great breakthrough for science, but just because you'd like to have one?
Yes, there is one. And I'll tell you, think about it. I've thought about this for many years. We all have microwave ovens, right? And you put it in, and in 10 seconds, this thing is super heated up. Why can't we make a microwave freezer? Instead of dunking it into liquid ice, you start out with a box, and it just is a box, like a microwave oven. You push a button, instant flash frozen. Think about that, and you'll have a good product. That's a kind of cute thing I'd like to see, because I like freezing broccoli, so it would be kind of interesting.
$1 million idea for one of you from Ira Flato. Well, let's take some questions from our audience. Just step right on up to our microphone. You see Abby right here, and don't be shy. Just jump right up. Make sure to say your name, where you're from, and then tell us your question.
Hi, I'm Regina Delaney. Ira, such a pleasure to have you here. This is a science question, not about the show. My husband and I were talking about climate control and things that were happening, and particularly the loss of the ice mass in the Arctic. And so he downloaded some NOAA information. And this thing just kind of blew our mind. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, polar ice. The average Arctic sea ice has gone down by 6.9% below average. And then it went on to say, in the opposite pole, the Antarctic sea ice was up by 20.3%. We can't figure out what's going on. Do you have any thoughts about
that? I can't
that?
Figure out what's going on. And these are all, you know, everybody can pull, that's what you learned about statistics, everybody can pull individual statistics out. But Antarctica is a large place. There are going to be places where there's more ice, and there are going to be places that there's less ice. I don't know which part of Antarctica that was, and I'm not a scientist to explain it, but there's one thing for sure, is that most scientists believe that global warming is real. And this is the other thing I want to just bring up. Why aren't we ever asking any of our politicians in this election season any questions about science, or what they believe about science? Why aren't we asking? I just want one simple question to be asked of how old is the Earth? That could start a long conversation. How old do you think the Earth is? So to the candidates, and then that would get into all kinds of different beliefs about things. And we don't have to give them the tough one, like why is it hotter in the summer than it is? Because I'm sure they'd all get that wrong. Anyhow.
Ken Harvey, Merrimack, New Hampshire. Pleasure to meet you. Here's a question you probably get all the time. Please explain dark energy and dark matter.
My favorite question. My favorite thought question. We had a scientist come on a few weeks ago who actually won the Nobel Prize for dark energy. And I walked him through this very carefully. It took about 15 minutes, step by step by step. I don't have that time or that brain to be able to do that. But here's the thing tonight when you go home and you look up in the sky and you look around us, everything that's visible to you, everything that you can see, the stars, the twilight, the galaxies, the planets, that's only 4% of the universe. 96% of the universe is dark. And we don't know what it is. It's divided up into dark matter, which we think is about 20-25%. We know it's there because we can see it's tugging on galaxies and things, so we know that's there. On the other hand, in the last 10 years or so, we've watched the universe do something different than we ever expected. Instead of slowing down and then going to come back, it actually started speeding up and pushing away from itself. And scientists call that dark energy. It's a repulsive force. That's dark energy, which makes up the greatest part of the universe, this dark energy. And not only is it mysterious that we have dark energy, but the theorists say we don't have enough of it. Because if you actually do the math, there should be like 100 times more of that dark energy out there if it is. But even that we can't find. So here we are in the 21st century thinking how smart we are, and we don't know what 96% of the universe is made out of. And
in a way, to borrow a phrase, it's one of those known unknowns. And that's actually pretty common in science. We know something is probably there, but
tough. The great thing that science advances is that it takes what you think you know to be true and turns it upside down. And that's the history of a science. That's the history of science thought. A new idea in science starts out like, you're nuts. Then it gets to be, you know, I think that's true. And then the third step is, I could have told you that years ago. You know. So we are with a lot of those things that you're in the nutty phrase. Yes.
Hi, my name is Rob Hunt. I'm from Gilmanton. And one thing that you mentioned was the question about the age of the Earth.
Right.
Don't you fear false science like intelligent design? And don't you view that to be a threat to real science?
Is a carbon dioxide molecule care whether you believe in it or not? It's a threat only as long as a majority of people might believe it. And I don't think a majority of people believe it. There was an interesting study that we're going to talk about again on this week on Science Friday, that for the first time, public opinion has swayed to that a majority of people do believe that global warming is real, and not only that our elected officials should do something about it. There gets to be a time where a paradigm shift happens. And when you see the seasons that we're going through, and you see there's no ice in the North Pole anymore in the summertime, you can't deny some of those things in your brain.
Hi, Leah Houck from Henniker. Is there a market on NPR for you to do a show every day of the week? to bring that kind of information.
I get asked that a lot.
And the other thing is, too,
Science Saturday.
You know, just things like the octopus and what you just said about, you know, the amount of space we can see versus what we don't know. I mean, those little tidbits that are sort of, you know, big pieces of information, not specific stuff, are what seems to be so mind-blowing for people that gets them turned around and goes, wow, science is really fascinating. And the idea of sort of being able to bring that to more people to just get them sparked.
Right. The beauty is in the details in science. You know, the devil may be there, but the beauty is really in knowing how the details of things work. We're always talking about creating another science program. It's a question of can you get shelf space on the radio? You know, something has to move out to get your side in there. But we're actually thinking about piloting another version, maybe an hour, just another hour-long version of Science Friday for possible weekends. On the other hand, there's infinite space on the internet.
Hi there. My name is Aubrey Nelson. I'm from Concord, New Hampshire. I'm a science teacher for elementary school kids. And I think that a lot of times in the school district, teachers are kind of intimidated by science as something that's very expensive.
Right.
And something that's very, maybe they don't feel like a scientist. And so they don't Right. feel like they have the credentials to teach it. And I was wondering your thoughts about more resourceful and more accessible science that we can use in classrooms so
right.
that we can hopefully change that statistic about how much science kids learn in school.
Well, that's a good question. We make our videos. We make a new video every week, and we have hundreds of them on our website. And we actually make teaching curricula out of them. You can get a whole lesson and questions to ask after watching the video on there. But I think you touch on a bigger issue, and that is how to have teachers teach science better, how to train them better. How to make the give kids, you know, access to them. If you talk to people who are interested in science, scientists, people like me, whatever, there's always been a mentor, someone who's taken a child by the hand and encouraged them, because kids all start out as natural scientists. And they take that Pop-Tart and stick it in the VCR, you know. They're doing an experiment. They want to know what happens. And instead of smacking them, we should just, you know, encourage them to do it in something different, in a little different form. But they all would like to see how that what is working there. I think that one of the things I believe in is that we don't teach science the right way to kids in school. We teach them all to become scientists. We don't teach them to appreciate and understand what science does. And I'll give you an example. When you learn art in school, they don't expect you to become Picasso when you're sitting there with your finger paints. But what they do want to expect you to do is appreciate art, to learn the beauty in the art, to learn about the artist, to learn how what made them excited about being an artist, how the art is constructed, blah, 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 about understanding and appreciating art. We don't have courses that teach you to understand and appreciate just science. How is science done? Who are great scientists? What motivated them? Not everybody has to learn, science to be a scientist. And I think we need more courses, perhaps in colleges, I think also in grammar schools, to teach what the joy of science is while kids are excited about exploring science, just like we would teach, understanding art or architecture or something else like that.
And to the broader public, do you find that museums and other public institutions like that are doing a good enough job, or
yeah, I think
does that need to change?
No, I think museums are doing very well, and they are helping fill the gap that teachers, I think some teachers, can't do.
Hi, Ira. Kirk Leone from Ware, New Hampshire. My question is, in today's dialogue that with rather polarized thought, there's this sense that religious thought or religious doctrine and science are opposite ends or polar concepts. And I think back at a time when perhaps people in, monks were some of the early scientists. What do you see as the role of religion or theology as it relates to science today?
I don't see science and religion as mutually exclusive, just historically speaking. You know, Isaac Newton was among the most religious of people in the world, and he was one of our greatest scientists. There are scientists today who are religious, consider them to be religious people, and they are some of the biggest scientists and the most creative scientists in the world. There are people who can put science in a box and religion in a box, and when they're in their science box, do their science, and when they're in their religion box, practice their religion. And I've never run across anybody who really can't do both, or a scientist who thinks that nobody can do that. I mean, there is a huge polarization, and there are some famous scientists who think that, you know, that it can't be done. But my experience in talking to scientists doesn't jive with that.
Hi, Mary from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Have you met a science issue that you just, no matter how hard you thought about it, you couldn't figure out? Or is there anything that, no matter how many times you talk about, people just don't get?
Quantum mechanics comes close.
I was just thinking that.
There's a great book called Quantum Mechanics for Poets. And it's a wonderful book. There's not one formula in it. But quantum mechanics is such a spooky thing. It's so spooky, yet it works so well. Richard Feynman, the famous physicist, said, if any scientist tells you why it works, they're lying. But it does work, and it's been tested over and over. But it still is not complete because we have not been able to unite all the forces in nature. But I thought you were heading in another direction, which is also a question. I have also found that it's very hard to ever change anybody's mind about anything. And whether you're, you know, politically scientific, it goes in the scientific world. If you want to believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old, then there's nothing I can tell you that's going to change your mind. And I came across this most recently, meaning in the last few years, with vaccination, saying that these vaccines are causing diseases. And I had a woman who came on, and she was talking about her experience with it, and she went on and on and on, and I wanted to listen to her because I wanted to hear what she had to say. And I finally said to her, is there any amount of evidence, any amount of research? I can stack the papers up high. I can bring you this and that, anything that will change your mind. And she said no. So that is one of the hardest challenges. And that's why in an election season, they're always looking for the undecided voter.
I'm Carter Barger from Center Harbor, New Hampshire. I'm dating myself, but I go back 55 years or so. And one of the greatest educators for young people of science, you remember the show Watch Mr. Wizard?
Mr. Wizard, Bob Herbert.
Why hasn't someone filled that gap? That was a wonderful show.
That's a good question. I used to know him, and I think the closest show to that now is Mythbusters. I did a show called Newton's Apple in the 80s, and the producers and I, thank you. You know, you're making me feel really old. The producers and I talk about that show, and we think, what would it have morphed into if it had stayed on the air? And they sort of think, and I sort of agree, that it would have been Mythbusters. People want, you know, something to explode. I mean, even as I got to the end of my tenure, there are certain things I wouldn't do, and I got the feeling that after a while, hey, they just want to put the host in trouble, you know? And the guy who took over for me, the first episode that he did is jumping out of an airplane. So I could tell that my time was up, you know, to do that show.
I won't introduce myself a second time, but my question is one about radio and how you got started with the program. Can you talk a little bit about the editorial conversation that went on at NPR to decide to dedicate this much time to a science show?
NPR has a long history of doing science. And probably does more science than anybody in the industry. When I started there in 1971, we used to take All Things Considered on the road for a week at a time to the AAAS meeting, American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting. We went to that one, the first one in Philadelphia in Christmas of 1971. I remember watching E.O. Wilson get a bucket of cold water poured over his head at that meeting for talking about his theories about, you know, ants and other social issues. Once got in trouble listening to the science of what makes things funny. Scientists were telling jokes. And as we got to the middle of the joke, I looked at the engineer sitting next to me and I said, I know the punchline of that joke. And it was too late. Could not bleep it out.
You mentioned scientists telling jokes, you do a joke show.
We did a great joke show, yes. We have now an annual joke show that's some great jokes on it. And, you know, we call it The Scientist Walks Into a Bar. And then you have to fill in, you know. It goes to something like a proton walks into a bar, says to the bartender, I'll have a beer. Bartender says, are you sure? The proton says, yes, I'm positive. You know, that sort of level of humor. But some of the...
Free beers for neutrons because there's no charge.
That's it. You've been listening. We had so many hundreds of people sending in jokes, and we actually would rate them, and it was very successful. We've done it. We actually did it the first time on the actual April Fool's Day a year ago, and this year we got as close as we could, and we tried to make it an annual event because science is humorous. Scientists are humorous just like everybody else, and why should you not have a good time talking about science like you would have talking about politics?
Well, we have had a really good time talking about science with you tonight. Ira Flatow, thank you so much for coming to New
thank
Hampshire.
Thank you for welcoming me.
It's poetry in motion. She turned a tender eye to me. Deep as any ocean. Sweet as any harmony. She blinded me with science. Feminine biology.
Ira Flatow, host of NPR's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. That conversation was recorded live at the University of New Hampshire's Memorial Union Building. The program was made possible with support from the University of New Hampshire, NEBCO, and Nathan Wexler and Company. Technical support was provided by Andrew Perella, and the live show was stage managed by Abby Goldstein, with event support from Becky Cates. The broadcast producer for this program was Rebecca Lavoie. I'm Brady Carlson, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Chemicals.
It's poetry in motion. When she turned her eyes to me.